day where the nights are gay and the sun shines daily on the mountain top. I took a trip on a sailing ship, and when I reached Jamaica, I made a stop. But I'm sad to say I'm on my way. Won't be back for many a day. My heart is down, my head is turning around. I had to leave a little girl in Kingston Town.
Over the course of 8 decades, Harry Belafonte has lived many lives. He was born into poverty and spent his childhood being shuttled between Harlem and the island of Jamaica. But that seems to have set the course for a career that would include many things: acting, singing, and a lot of work as an activist. He was on our show in October to discuss a book he'd written about his life called My Song, a Memoir, and a documentary called Sing Your Song that was about to air on HBO. It was a great conversation, and we thought that we would re-air it for you today during this holiday week. I began by noting that the memoir opens with a phone call he'd received in early August 1964 that led him to travel to Mississippi, and I asked Harry Belafonte, were you afraid that night when you and Sidney Poitier touched down on that dirt landing strip in Greenville?
Yes. I think we were filled with a lot of apprehension and anxiety. It's not the first time I had been south, and I'm not too sure how often Sydney may have been prior to that, but the mission itself was somewhat daunting, and I was required to take an awful lot of money down to Greenwood, Mississippi for the freedom movement, for the freedom, for the students on the freedom registration for black voters, and it was a large sum of money. It was just at the time that Schwerner, Goodwin, and Cheney had been missing, only to be found some days later.
So they had not yet been found?
No.
Wow, but you were really putting yourself in danger, I would think.
I think going to the South, whether there was such a tragic event as what happened to the three civil rights workers, going to the South, coming from the North, and having the visibility that some of us did, was always putting oneself in harm's way. Mm-hmm. And one had to work at trying to overcome that fact and just get on with the task at hand.
Well, but this was just 8 years after the release of Calypso, which we just heard something from.
Yes.
And so you hadn't been all that famous all that long by this time, but a lot of stuff had happened. Calypso came out. First artist in history to sell 1 million albums and also introduce the music of the Caribbean to the rest of the world. And then not long afterward, you became a friend of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes.
So suddenly you were on the fast track, weren't you?
Well, I got to tell you that from my point of view, my life has always been on the fast track, even since my infancy. But in this instance, referring to your observations about the period, yes, it was very much on a fast track.
And a year before the flight to Mississippi, you'd helped organize the March on Washington, just exactly a year before,
yes.
August 1963.
Yes, exactly.
Who were your early inspirations in terms of being an activist and the whole notion of fighting against injustice?
Well, there were three people who stand out very clearly, and that was Paul Robeson, great American artist and citizen, Eleanor Roosevelt, the wife of the President of the United States when I was born, Franklin Roosevelt, and Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, who was a great educator from Harvard, who did a lot to write and document the story of black America.
And were you friends with Robeson, Eleanor Roosevelt, and W.E.B. Du Bois?
Yes, I was friends with all of them, thanks to their generosity, their openness, their willing to bring me into their world, and gave me space to help work on the things they were working on.
But this is the time of McCarthyism, and Du Bois had been a communist. Robeson was accused of being a communist, whether he was or not is a whole other matter. Couldn't that have had a negative effect on your career?
Yes, but then everybody that I liked, everybody that I loved, everybody who was deeply committed to the struggle of black people and people who were just ground onto were being attacked and accused. I have to make one correction. Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois was not a member of the Communist Party during his life. It wasn't until his, as a matter of very close to death in Ghana, where he had gone into exile, that he decided as a last act of vengeance against the state to join the Communist Party, which he did openly and officially. Prior to that, he'd been accused and just refused to ever discuss whether he was or wasn't. But Eleanor Roosevelt was accused of being a communist by the McCarthy people. Robeson, certainly, his friendship for the Soviet Union and his great love of Russian culture and the many friends that he had there gave him a place of endearment towards what the Soviet Union, in his mind, stood for. What really began to deeply provoke or challenge him was the fact that he soon found that a lot of his friends, particularly ones who were Jewish and were intellectuals and writers and poets and artists, were beginning to just disappear, and that caused him great concern.
I would assume that as a result of these relationships, you had a huge FBI file of your own.
Yes, I did, and it took me a long time to get it after many, 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 many denials that they had such a file or that one was being kept, and just with persistence and with a lot of legal intervention, I finally got parts of my file which were so marked out and blacked out that it was almost obscene and insulting that they would send me a long file with almost every sentence blacked out.
Although Paul Robeson Jr. talks about going over his father's file and figuring out that some of his father's best friends were actually reporting on him to the FBI. He could figure it out by the circumstances that the report was on, even if the name was blacked out.
Yes, after a while you develop...
You can get paranoid, couldn't you?
Well, one could become paranoid. I'm not too sure some of us weren't touched with a bit of it. It didn't go to the extreme. But yes, you're always... I remember once talking to Paul Robeson himself, when I had talked about the fact that I felt that we had discovered someone who had betrayed us. And Paul listened carefully, and then he said, let's not be too hasty unless you have absolute proof and were there when exchanges took place on the information. You can't be too sure. And he made the point, what happens if somebody says, you were very upset at the time that the Rosenbergs were executed by the state, and you made a remark, and you and that person were sitting alone in a car, as was the case, incidentally. And then all of a sudden you get feedback from the House Un-American Activities Committee that you were heard to make this utterance and to do that. Well, I'd never said what I said before this to anybody else but this individual from who was being quoted. And then Paul said to me, that might seem like great evidence, but what happens if this person, not knowing anything, went to a poker game, played that night, made some remarks,
and said, Harry Belafonte said this to
and me. 16 other ears picked it up. How do you know which one of them? He said, what you cannot do is to let that turn you around and make you and impede you in your goals in life.
Do you feel that it had an effect on your career?
There's no question that a lot of these things had effects on my career. I mean, when you get blacklisted in ways that are extremely arbitrary, there were some guys upstate New York who ran a little vigilante journal called Aware and Counterattack, and they just listed names for people whom they thought were communists, not too unlike the Tea Party today, who just go out and pick with vengeance and with vigilante spirit those whom they want to destroy or taint. And once that gets out, and those who choose to use that information uses it indiscriminately without checking sources, which was quite prominent during that period.
Can we go back to your childhood? How did you? Sure. What were the circumstances of your going back and forth between Jamaica and New York?
My mother was an immigrant from Jamaica. She came here like most immigrants, looking for the American dream and feeling that opportunity resided here for her. And when she came, she discovered that that may have been true for some immigrants, particularly the ones of coming from Europe, but it was not true for immigrants of color. And she found, as a matter of fact, America far more harsh in its race relations than she had experienced in the island of Jamaica, which was under British rule at the time. And in her efforts to try to meet the urgencies of the time, she was, for all intent and purposes, a single parent. My father was a drifter, an alcoholic, was hardly ever at home. When he did come home, it was a celebration of just abject cruelty because he was so violent. And my mother paid a price for all of that. And she eventually felt that the city and all of its conditions so overwhelmed her that it would be better off for her children to go back to Jamaica and grow up in the village in which she was born and she grew up, so that we'd be better off being raised by a village than by the mischief of the streets of New York.
But then you did come back to Harlem.
Yes, I came back when I was 12.
And what were your feelings during that time when you and your mother passed as immigrants from Spain in order to be able to rent an apartment in a nicer building than you had lived in previously?
Well, that fact was not common to just us. Everybody had to have a scheme if you wanted to live in a what they call the Rupert Murdoch. I'm sorry.
Not Jacob, Rupert Murdoch.
Not Rupert Murdoch. But he ain't so hot either while I'm at it. But this guy was Jacob Rupert. He was a big bear baron, and he had these houses within the black and the Hispanic and the poor communities. He had many, many such houses. And to get a Rupert Murdoch apartment, I'm sorry, Jacob Rupert apartment.
He had Knickerbocker beer, among other things.
That's it. Was to get a good apartment, good maintenance, and if you got in, you were lucky. And the way to get in was to have nothing to do with being of African descent. You could tell them anything, that you were Spanish, you were French, you were Greek, just as long as you didn't identify yourself as a black American or an African. And that's how my mother got into these places.
Was that the first time you had to deal with the notion of authenticity? Because later, that was a concern when you became known as a folk singer.
Well, the concern was, yes, the concern with that problem was that there were a group of very elite folk artists who kept embracing this thought that there was such a thing as an authentic folk singer. And I failed to understand how they defined authenticity. Folk songs are resplendent in the universe. It has been there since the beginning of time. Everybody, like my friend Brownie McGee once said, all songs are folk songs because he never heard a horse sing. I thought it was a point well taken. Anyway, in that clash, yeah, I didn't have a banjo over my back. I didn't come from a church tradition. I knew very little about the deeper songs and the resonance of black America. I knew a lot about the Caribbean. But then when I started to get into this and make my repertoire based upon selections I'd made from across the spectrum of music that I was exposed to, I then just shunned that criticism, just put it aside, got on with my business, and eventually it made no difference whether I was an authentic or an unauthentic folk singer.
My guest is Harry Belafonte. He's written a memoir with the help of Michael Schneerson called My Song. It's published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. That's Harry Belafonte in duet with Miriam Makeba singing Train Song. He was on our show in October to discuss a memoir called My Song that he had written in collaboration with Michael Schneerson, and we're replaying that conversation for you today. One of the things that we discussed was the HBO documentary called Sing Your Song that was about to air, and I asked Harry Belafonte, does that cover your life and the same story you tell here in this memoir?
Yes. As a matter of fact, this whole process started with doing a film. I hadn't the foggiest idea what I would do with the film, but I just knew that I had to document some experiences that were still accessible to me from a historic point of view. And as I got into it and the volumes kept pouring in, it was obvious that when we edited the film that the story was much too large, and therefore a book became a consideration. And then when Knopf stepped to the table and said we would be interested in taking the book, I then thought about it seriously and then did the book that comes out on the 11th.
You served in the U.S. Navy the end of World War II.
Yes, I did.
At that time, the U.S. military was segregated.
Well, people ask me, where did you serve? What front? And I said, I served on the 4th Front. And they said, what in the world is the 4th Front? I said, well, there was the Pacific Front, there was the European Front, then there was the African Front, and then there was the South of the United States of America and America, the 4th Front. And many of us of color who served in the armed forces suffered the wretched conditions of a segregated South. Many of our camps and training places were in the South. Many of our officers came from a Southern culture and mentality and therefore had history replete with the cruelties that many of them heaped upon black soldiers and the kind of problems we had then. And I was in the United States Navy and had the same experience.
And then there were also differences between people from the Caribbean and people whose their families had grown out of the slavery of the South. And distinctions were made, weren't they?
Well, those distinctions were made more in Harlem than they were in the United States Navy, because it's one thing to live in Harlem, which is by definition considered a ghetto. And inside that ghetto reside a number of people who come from different cultures that make up their own little pockets. So it's ghettos within ghetto. And as a Caribbean, I lived primarily in the Caribbean section of Harlem. Well, all these labels followed me into service. And when I got into the service, ran into many people who came from the same background.
After the war, you served as a janitor's assistant in New York. What did you think your life was going to be like then?
I thought I'd just make the best damn janitor's assistant anybody ever saw.
So how did you wind up at the American Negro Theater? Just by accident?
Yes, by coincidence, accident. I was serving as a janitor's assistant. My task was to do the most menial of tasks in the building. One of them was to repair a Venetian blind for a tenant, a woman by the name of Clarice Taylor, who turned out in later life to be not only a very well-known black actress, but she turned out to play Bill Cosby's mother in the Bill Cosby show. Anyway, Clarice, I was her janitor, and came up and repaired the Venetian blind. She gave me 2 tickets as a gratuity to the American Negro Theater, which I'd never heard of. And I walked down into the library at the Schomburg in the basement to see what black theater was about. I was very familiar with the theaters of music, the Apollo Theater and all the places where the big bands and the great singers of the day, but I'd never been into a dramatic theater environment, theater of drama. And that was the first time I'd ever seen it. And it was an epiphany for me, because what I saw opened me up and revealed for me a place that I would never, ever leave. I knew that I had found where I wanted to be and to be among people I wanted to be among, even though I did not specifically know what choices I wanted to make. I just hungered for that environment and stayed there until eventually I got caught up in the system of the theater, did a lot of things there until I was offered a part in a play.
And without training.
Without training.
Now, were you already singing at that point?
No, but I tell you, I think people from the Caribbean sing all their lives. I mean, we hardly do very much more than sing. at least back in those days. And singing was so much a part of my life, but not with any intentions of becoming professional or doing it as a way of life. That was not on the table. But when I saw the theater and saw acting and understood the depth of poetry, I took a great attraction to the idea of reading. I was a dropout from high school, never finished it, had a terrible time.
You went up to the ninth grade, and then you were self-taught from then on?
Oh, if you can call it that. You know, life forced me to learn. But when I dropped out of high school, I had dyslexia. Nobody hardly knew what that meant. I know it's popularly used today to describe a lot of things, but I genuinely had the disorder and went off to the Navy and came back. And my skills were no better than being a janitor's assistant. And when I got into the theater and saw what happened to the American Negro Theater, I found an appetite to read, a need to know, a need to be able to converse on the subjects of the day. And that propelled me into the life that I have since enjoyed.
And you went on without training, but then you did take acting lessons in a group of pretty talented students, including Marlon Brando?
Yes, well, the New School of Social Research, which was just at its dawning at that time here in New York, had opened up a drama department. And knowing that I needed to have a deeper understanding of the art of theater and acting, I registered for that school under the support of the GI Bill of Rights. The federal government paid our tuition. And I studied. And it was social theater all the way. A man by the name of Irwin Piscotta, mm-hmm. from the Max Reinhardt Theater, the days of Bertolt Brecht and the Brechtian writings of the period and stuff. He brought a huge amount of material to us. And in my class, the first day I walked in to start the first semester, were Marlon Brando, Walter Matthau, Rod Steiger, Tony Curtis, B. Arthur, and it went on and on. And the one curio among all of us was, we looked at each other and wondered, why did we select to be in the theater? We looked at each other and said, we'll never make it. Not only did we make it, but what an impact that small crowd had on the culture of their time.
My guest is Harry Belafonte, who has written a memoir called My Song. It's published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When did you meet Sidney Poitier?
At the American Negro Theater. As a matter of fact, just about the day, almost the same day I walked in. He walked in. And we had watched each other for a long time. We didn't have much to say to one another at the beginning. But Sidney was inordinately quiet, spoke very little, if at all. And he seemed so completely internalized and withdrawn until others in the group began to wonder what was the true measure of his silence. Why was he so internalized? And I had the audacity, while he and I were charged with a duty underneath the stage of the theater to take old boxes and get out old costumes and clean them up in that quiet space during this, taking on this duty, I said to him, have you ever been to jail? And he became deeply offended. And he looked at me and said, why do you ask that? With his teeth clenched. And I said, I just wondered. You're so silent. And I know people who are as silent as you, because many of them reside in my family because they live outside the law. And I know what silence means among those who are in the business of doing things illegal. And it was the only thing that came to my mind. And he said, well, you're still looking for the answer.
And he, but you did become friends, obviously.
Well, eventually I wore him down.
And meanwhile, you also had a pretty auspicious beginning as a singer. You ended up on a stage with Lester Young, Charlie Parker, Max Roach, some of the greatest musicians in the history of jazz. Originally, were you thought of as a jazz singer?
Well, that's how I was billed when I finally got the job to sing. I had discovered singing and the platform of singing through a play that we'd done at the New School of Social Research called Of Mice and Men, a play written by John Steinbeck. And a character had been created by the director called the Troubadour. And the job of the Troubadour was behind scenes and during light changes and mood changes to evoke a song that came out of that period of the Dust Bowl and during the American Great Depression. And I had to find these songs or were found for me, and I sang them during given strategic moments in the unfolding of the play. And almost all the songs were written by Woody Guthrie and by Leadbelly. So with that repertoire from those two men, I then approached this material not as a singer, but as a character in the play, and approached it as an actor, and therefore I had no inhibitions about it. But that was about the extent of my repertoire. Some of the guys from the Royal Roost, the nightclub, the jazz nightclub, came, because it was just a block and a half away. I knew them, invited them to come see the play. They came, and they came to the theater with great regularity, because they also discovered Marlin and others, that it's not a bad joint. I said, you're right. So when I was explaining to them some many months later that bad fortune had fallen my way because I ran out of money, the GI Bill was no longer usable, they said, well, why don't you just try to sing some songs and come on in. Monty Kay, who was the name of the promoter, said, he liked to play, so you can sing. And I laughed at it. But they made the overture. Monty said, get some songs and come on in. And I learned songs with a guy named Al Haig, who was the
great jazz pianist.
And I just learned with him. When I walked up on the stage that night in the middle of the first sitting of the audience coming in, and I was to fill the space because I was the intermission singer, before I could get through the vamp to lead me into my first song, which was Pennies from Heaven, up walked Max Roach and sat in on the drums. Tommy Potter picked up his bass. Al at the piano, and then Bird came.
Well, Al Haig was Charlie Parker's pianist.
He was Charlie Parker's pianist. As a matter of fact, those guys were in his band at the time. Max, although they had title of their own, they played with each other, constantly each other's band.
Wow.
And that was my first backup band, and I never looked back from that moment. But that act of generosity so overwhelmed me that it set for me a very early condition under which I would use the rest of my life as an artist, and that was to always give the platform to others who are in need.
Now, Calypso wasn't your first recording, but it was your first major breakthrough, sold a million copies, and really introduced Calypso music to a lot of people who had never heard it before. And some of those songs remain standards. I mean, you can't say Deo without somebody... or, you know...
Well, you can't say it at the Yankee Stadium and get away without getting a response. Yeah, it's a strange twist and a wonderful one. But what happened when Robeson, when he first heard me sing, said to me very simply, I looked for his anointing, and he was very generous, and he said, you're on the right track, Harry. And he said, let me tell you something. It's a simple idea. He said, but get them to sing your song and they'll want to know who you are. So Get Them to Sing Your Song became the title of the picture, Sing Your Song, and then ultimately the title of the book. When he told me that, I did not quite understand the power of the metaphor, what his prophecy alluded to, until that record hit. And I woke up one day and the whole world was singing Deo, and I knew then that I had this. They were singing my song, and I had a platform.
In a lot of ways, your career was similar to Robeson's because you're an actor, singer, and a political activist. You knew Bobby Kennedy when he was still working for McCarthy, didn't you?
I knew of him. Mm-hmm. I didn't get to know him personally until he was appointed to become Attorney General of the United States of America by his brother, who was then the president.
What did you think at the time? Did you think that the Kennedy brothers were going to do something important in terms of race?
We were deeply concerned that the history of Bobby Kennedy coming to this position of such power would be one of our most difficult adversaries. He was with McCarthy, had no particular... He never indicated that he had any care for the left. There was no particular history about him in relationship to black people. He was just completely unknown to us, except for those headlines that said he worked for the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Bigger surprise was Lyndon Johnson, who pushed through the civil rights legislation, even though he was from a southern state. You've been doing a lot of work with...
Well, just I want to finish up one thing on Bobby Kennedy. When he came, and we saw in him this adversary, Dr. King listened to all who had comments to make. And he said, in this man sits good. Good sits in all people. Your task is to find his moral center and to win him to our cause. So we had a mission to set out and really win him over, thinking that he had space for us. And we did that. And once he saw the light and came to our side of the ledger, it carried him through the rest of his life.
Do you think of yourself as being in retirement these days?
I tried to play that game, and it will not permit me. I tried to go on the beaches and just lay out and sip a rum while I watched the world drift by and watch the waves eternally wash on shore and ebb and tide. And then in my mind, things keep calling at me. There's a lot to do. Get back to New York, hook it up, and move to the next day. So I did that.
And now you're working with gangs and prison populations and doing other things. And now you also have a memoir. Harry Belafonte has won both the Tony Award and an Emmy. He was awarded the National Medal of Arts by President Clinton. He served as a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador, as recipient of the Kennedy Center Honors for Excellence in the Performing Arts. And he has written a memoir called My Song with the help of Michael Schneerson that is published by Knopf. There's also an HBO documentary that will be broadcast next Monday at 10 p.m., all of which makes me quite pleased that I've had this opportunity to speak with you.
I can't thank you enough for giving me the chance to speak to you and your audience.
Daylight come and me won't go home.